and turn to 1 Peter 3, chapter 7. I mean, 1 Peter 3, verse 7. 1 Peter 3, verse 7. So this is Peter writing, and he says, "Likewise, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way, showing honor to the woman as the weaker vessel, since they are heirs with you of the grace of life, so that your prayers may not be hindered." This is Peter basically laying out some parameters for a man leading his wife and how he might care for her in a more attentive way. Paul has gotten at that a little bit in Ephesians. We read that passage earlier. Paul says that men are supposed to lead their wives. Wives are supposed to submit to the leadership of their husbands. But Paul says there's a particular way to do it, in the same way husbands should love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ does the church, because we're members of his body. Paul's saying that there's a particular way in which a man is supposed to lead his wife, a way that he is to care for her. And he makes allusion here to the one flesh relationship. Man shall leave his mother and father, cleave to his wife, two shall become one flesh. The one flesh relationship. And since it's a one flesh relationship, his husband should care for his wife in such a way that it's second nature, like he would care for himself. That's why Paul says, what man ever hated his own flesh? But he nourishes his own flesh. He cherishes his own flesh. And so I had a bagel downstairs just now. I sat at a table, and not one of you came up to me at all during that entire time of eating to say, "We've never seen anything like this before. You're a man of courage. You're a man of character. You got hungry, and you came down here in the basement. You got food, and you fed yourself." Of course you didn't say that. Why? Because of course I got hungry. I got hungry and I went down there and got some food, just like the rest of you. Second nature. Nobody gets an award for eating and feeding themselves. No man gets an award for getting hungry and finding food and eating it. I've been injured a handful of times doing different things and required a few stitches a few times in my life. And I've never one time in an emergency room had a physician come out to me and say, "Sir, you know, we've never seen anything like this. You must be a man of unbelievable character. You got hurt and you came here to get yourself fixed." Unbelievable. Of course, they don't say that, because of course I did. I got cut and I needed stitches. I got myself to an emergency room. Why? Because what man ever hated his own flesh? But he nourishes it. He feeds it. He cherishes it. He gets it fixed. It's second nature. And what Paul is saying in the Ephesians is that just as second nature as it is for us to care for our own bodies, now that we are married, as a man, your wife is part of you, and you should care for her just as intently and as attentively as you care for your own self. Colossians 3, Paul's writing, he says, "Husbands, love your wives and don't be harsh with them." Why would he say that? Why would he have to tell a man? Then later on he says, "Children, obey your parents in everything. And then fathers, do not provoke your children lest they become discouraged." So he doesn't say, "Wives, don't be harsh with your husbands." He doesn't say, "Mothers, don't provoke your children." Why would he tell men these two things? Don't be harsh with your wife and don't provoke your children. Because it's very easy for a man who, in a Genesis 3 world, right, he has to work. He goes off to work, and what the Bible says as a result of the fall is that now a man's work is going to be fraught with thorns and thistles by the sweat of his brow. He's going to go to work now, and there are going to be obstacles, and there are going to be challenges. There are going to be things in his way, things that make his work more difficult, things that make his work more frustrating, things that make his work more hard and difficult. And then he comes home. And what might he do? As a result of a challenging day of working with thorns and thistles and the sweat of his brow and obstacles, and he might tend to be harsh with his wife, talk to her and treat her just like one of the boys. A man can say things to another man and it doesn't bother him at all. right? We can be direct with one another. We can say things, hey, you know, that looks ridiculous. Who dressed you today? Well, things we would never say to our wives, right? Or shouldn't. I mean, you could go ahead and try that. Guys can talk to one another in a way that women don't appreciate fully. My best friends in Louisville, we tell each other just straight, just like it is. And our wives will listen to us talk, and they'll say, if we talked to each other like that, we wouldn't talk to each other for months, right? So don't be harsh with them. And then we come here to 1 Peter 3, and 1 Peter, and Peter gives us several things. He says, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way. What does that mean? It means you treat your wife uniquely, not generically. You're supposed to know her. She's not just anybody. She's your wife. And so to live with her in an understanding way means that you need to know things about her, and you need to study her. You need to be aware of things like, what's her favorite color? What's her favorite restaurant? What blesses her? You should be aware of the ways that she is making your life better, that she is sanctifying you, that God is using her in your life. Many of us men will spend a lifetime thinking that the things that we don't like about our wives are just irritants that we've got to live with. What if God put her in your life so that the things that she's bringing to the table that you might actually embrace a little bit in your life? Maybe that's what God had in mind. Not that you would just have this annual daily irritant that you just have to live with for 40 years. Maybe God is trying to change you, and he's using her to do it. So for me, I'm not a stop and smell the roses kind of a guy. I have a goal. I like to get to it. Sometimes people can get in the way of my goal, and I'm a list maker. I remember our first vacation we went on, we had been married about 8 months. We went to Savannah, Georgia, and we're at a restaurant at night. We had just gotten there, stopped to get something to eat, and I'm with a pen on a napkin writing down all the things we're going to do tomorrow, everything we're going to get done. She said, what are you doing? I said, I'm writing down everything we need to get done while we're here, all the places we're going to see. She said, well, what if we just woke up tomorrow and just see what happens? Well, we can be out of God's will if you want to, but we're not going to get done what God's will is, because I already wrote it on a napkin. This is what we're supposed to do. I said, we won't get anything done. She said, I think I'm okay with that. Well, I don't have any category for that. I mean, what's the matter with you? Who did I marry? We've only been married 8 months. I'm thinking, man, what in the world is going on here? So, not this January, but last January, we went on our 20-year anniversary trip. That was a trip of a lifetime. And I had the greatest vacation I've ever had in my whole life. Do you know why? Because we did nothing. Nothing. We didn't plan anything. We just went to this place and hung out and did nothing. Now, I could have spent the last 20 years lamenting the fact that my wife smells the roses and I don't, and I can't believe that what's wrong with her and doing that. Or I could say, God put us together. I believe God put us together, and maybe I need to stop and smell the roses a little more. And so 20 years later, I stop and smell the roses a little more. And 20 years later, she'll make a list a little more than she used to. God's shaping us together, one flesh. And I know her, and I know this about her. I know the things that she's bringing to the table that I need in my life, that I have identified as good things that I could identify as irritants, but I'm not going to do that because God is sovereign. God knows me. He knows who he gave to me to be my wife, and it is not my job to make sure my wife turns out exactly like me 20 years later. What if, crazy thought, God wants you to change? Maybe you need to be a little kinder. Maybe you and I need to be a little more gentle. Maybe you and I need to be a little more patient. And maybe God has brought our wives into our lives so that we might just exhibit a little more of the fruit of the Spirit. You need to know what blesses her. What blesses her? What does she like? Does she like walks instead of dessert? Does she like to go out for dessert instead of a meal? Does she like seafood? Does she like Italian? See, all these things, you say, well, what does it have to do with you? Well, it has to do with you living with her in an understanding way and knowing her and identifying the things that, that are unique about her so that you can be attentive to her. It's fun for me. The thing about buying gifts in our home, nobody gets to ask for a gift. Nobody gets to say, this is what I want for my birthday. Nobody does. I don't do it. The kids don't do it. Nobody gets to do it. Because part of the thrill in our home that I think I'm bringing to the table here, part of the thrill is for me to know what everybody likes. I like to be a student of everybody, and I know what makes them smile. I know what their favorite candy is. I know what they're interested in, and I know what they like, and I know what would bless them. And so we go to the store and we pick out things that they've identified that, hey, Mom, when we were at the store with Mom the other day, she saw this and I could tell she really liked it, but she didn't buy it. That's what I'm talking about. Because then we go buy it. And then we wrap it up and we put it there. And she says, how did you know? I was going to buy this the other day and I decided not to buy it, but I want. How did you? Yeah, because we're students of one another. See, we're training one another to be a student. People that know me well know that I still eat like a third grader. I don't like vegetables. I try to eat them, and I'm doing the best I can. But it's just the vegetables. I'm just working on it. And so let's just say I go home. I fly home tomorrow, and Dana says, honey, you've had a long weekend. I appreciate you doing that. And glad you're home, and I just want to honor you. And what I've done today is I have cooked the most incredible vegetable souffle you've ever seen in your whole life. Here it is. Well, I'm torn, right? On one hand, I'm like, I'm glad she's showing some appreciation. But on the other hand, I want to say, you don't even know me. Vegetable souffle? You don't know me. The way to my heart is beef. That's how you get to my heart. Or anything else that had parents, right? But not vegetables. Meat. My fear is a lot of us, our wives, are sitting around saying, you just don't know me. We're still insisting that they should be blessed by what blesses us. And we're doing things for them that bless us, that we would be blessed by, and we don't get it. And we think, well, and she's just saying, okay, I appreciate it. I see that you're making a nice gesture, but you really don't know me. This is an imperative command. We are supposed to live with our wives in an understanding way and know them and not be... Look, young men, if you have sisters or you're around other young women, it's very important. Just realize they're all unique. They all have different personalities. They like different things. Different things bless them. Every woman is unique. So husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way, showing honor to the woman as the weaker vessel. Showing honor to her as the weaker vessel. What could that mean? Well, here's what it doesn't mean. It doesn't mean that she's weaker intellectually. It doesn't mean that she's weaker spiritually, like she has less capacity of spiritual ability. I think it's just a straightforward reading of the text. She's weaker physically. Most women are physically weaker than men. By chemical design, estrogen softens bones, diminishes muscle tissue. Testosterone hardens bones and develops muscle tissue. Generally speaking, most men are physically stronger than most women. And I think what Paul is saying here is Peter is saying here is you show honor to her that she's weaker physically, and you honor her in that. Here's what this means at bare minimum. You don't lay hands on her. You don't manhandle her. This is Peter's prohibition against physical abuse. You show honor to her as a weaker vessel. You don't lay hands on her. You don't use your physical strength to manhandle her, to get your way with her. I would even argue that what this means is you don't use your physical strength to intimidate. You say, well, I didn't touch her. Yeah, but you sure stepped forward and used your physical presence in such a way to intimidate her to get your way, or to intimidate her into backing down from something that she thinks is right and knows is right. I've had to do that with other men before. Handful of times in my life where I think something's about to escalate and I take a step toward a man and I say, don't you do that again. What am I doing? I didn't touch him, but I stepped forward in such a way and I pointed in such a way that I used my physical presence to let him know something's going to go down here if you do that again. And some men do that. They say, well, I've never touched my wife. Yeah, okay, that's good. But you've also used your physical presence to to intimidate. And this is what you show honor as the weaker vessel. How do you do that? Well, we've got two different kinds of plates in our house. We've got these little plastic plates that we get from Walmart, and they're like 20 cents a piece. And I don't care what you do to them. I really don't. You can drop them on the ground. We throw them in the dishwasher. The boys and I, if they're totally empty, we'll fling them across the kitchen and try to land them in the sink. If the boys are outside in the back deck and I've got a plate in my hand, I'll fling it down there and try to hit them in the head with it while they're walking around by the pond. And I don't even care what happens to the plate. I really could care less about what happens to the plate. They get all scratched up. We buy 20 more for $4, right? I mean, it's just nothing. They're durable. They're strong. But they're cheap. We have some other plates in our house that if the kids even look at them, they're in trouble. I don't even want to look at them. I don't want to see them. They're tucked away. Why? Because they're china. It's fine china. And it's handed down from great-great-grandmothers. And when we eat on it, it is like a production. And I don't even like, I can't even enjoy the meal because I'm afraid something's going to happen to the plate. I'm going to do something wrong to the plate. And then when we wash them, we wash them by hand. We don't put them in the dishwasher. We dry them by hand. And then we carry them like it's the Ark of the Covenant. And we put them in the thing. And then we shut the doors. Why? Because they're weaker, right? But way more valuable. And we treat them with greater care, not lesser care. So weak doesn't mean cheap. Weak doesn't mean less valuable. What Peter is saying here is weakness means greater care, greater honor, greater value. It's like you would handle a fine china. As a man, we should be treating the women in our lives, all the women in our lives. Peter's dealing with wives, but young men, listen, you have sisters, you have friends, there are girls at church, you college students, there are women on your campus. This is the way you practice showing honor to your wife. This is the way you practice being a man of God, is how you treat the women around you even before you're married. And so you show them honor as the weaker vessel. You have a sense of protection over them. They don't walk anywhere by themselves. They don't go dangerous places by themselves. You show honor. When we go into a restaurant, the first thing the boys do is figure out where the bathrooms are. And if there's an emergency exit by the bathroom, they're on full-time alert. And when their sisters go to the bathroom, they know, they just get up. They don't ask me. They get up and they go stand back there. Why? Because that's one of the most dangerous places in the world. Now, I don't want to put everybody on alarm, and I'm not an alarmist about somebody getting kidnapped. I'm just telling you right now, 2 seconds. An emergency exit by a bathroom. Little girl goes to the bathroom by herself. She comes out, boom, gone. Just like that. So I'm not paranoid in my house, but we're protective and we're looking after the girls in our home. And so the boys go stand there like a sentinel. And they watch those girls, and the girls go in and they come out and they stand right there. Why? Because they're just showing honor. Opening up a door, it's not just chivalry, it's honor. If a woman says, don't open the door for me, I can open the door myself. She doesn't want to be honored. She hasn't been honored. She doesn't know what it's like to be honored. Don't be mad at her. Be mad at the other men in her life that haven't shown her any honor. So we're going to show honor to the woman as the weaker vessel. In our home, the boys do the ugly stuff, the smelly stuff, the gross stuff, taking out the garbage. It's not that the girls can't take out the garbage. They are perfectly capable. We just have told the boys, just do the ugly stuff. That's what you're made for. You're not made for pretty. You're made for ugly. All right? Look at you. I mean, just look at us in here. Do the ugly stuff. When Dana brings a van load of groceries home, if the weather's good, all the kids go out and carry them in. If it's raining, the boys do it. It's not because the girls will melt if they get wet. Our girls love to be outside and be adventurous. It's just, we're just trying to make a point. All right? We're just trying to make a point that if it's ugly, if it's harder, if it's the weather's harsher, then the boys exclusively go do it. Not because the girls aren't allowed or can't. It's just, I want to send a message. And I don't live on a farm, and I live in a subdivision with an eighth of an acre, and you know, there's not a lot of opportunity to do ugly and hard and difficult. So whenever there is an opportunity, the boys do it to show honor to the women in our home. And they practice showing honor to their wives by how they honor their sisters. They practice showing honor to their wives by how they honor the girls at church and any other place where they happen to encounter them. So live with your wives in an understanding way, showing honor to the woman as a weaker vessel, since they are heirs with you of the grace of life. This is one of the most interesting parts of this passage. Peter is reminding husbands that their wives are equal to them. Isn't that amazing? That a man would have to be reminded that his wife is his equal? Why would he be? This is preemptive. This is Peter, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, anticipating that one day down the road in a fallen world, men who lead anything are going to start to believe that the reason why they're leading the people that they're leading is because they're better than the people that they're leading. It's preemptive. That's why Paul writes to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 6. He says, don't sue one another. Better to be defrauded. It's preemptive. Why would he say that? Don't do that, because you're going to be tempted to sue one another. In a fallen world, you're going to be tempted to sue one another. And you're going to be tempted to prove that you're right and demonstrate that you're right. And Paul says, don't do that. Better to be defrauded than to sue one another. James says, don't treat the rich better than the poor. Why? Because in a fallen world, you're going to be tempted to treat the rich better than the poor and give them a more prominent place. They can buy things. They can pay for things. They can build buildings. They can do all sorts of things. And we'll bring the rich up front and treat them with special honor and treat the poor with neglect. And James says, don't do that. In a fallen world, you're going to be tempted to do that. Don't do that. This is exactly what's happening here. Peter, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, is anticipating. You might think that the reason why you're leading this woman over a period of time is, well, of course I'm leading her. I'm better. God needed me to lead her. I'm better than her. And this is, Peter says, no. No, you're not. You are not. And you're to be reminded that you're joint heirs of the grace of life. She is your equal, and you treat her as such. Live with her in an understanding way. Treat her with honor as a weaker vessel. You treat her as an equal. And what happens if we don't? What happens if we don't? This is a warning to all of us. The challenge of leadership in a fallen world. Because Peter says, so that your prayers may not be hindered. If you don't do these things that he said, your prayers will be hindered. Let me tell you what that means and doesn't mean. First of all, it has been said that men don't really care about this punishment because they don't pray enough for it to matter in the first place. I hope that's not me or you. But it's possible some men pray so little that to find out God's not going to hear their prayer, well, they're not praying much anyway, so they don't care. Other men think that what this means is there's a handful of things I have been praying for, and I'm just not going to get those things. Big screen TV, lake house, new boat. There's a handful of things I've been asking for, and I'm just not going to get them, so I can live without those things. That's not exclusively what this means. It probably means at least that. But here's what happens. This is God saying, I'm turning a deaf ear toward you. If you don't honor your wife and treat your wife the right way, and young men who aren't married, I'm going to argue there's a corollary to this. And I'm going to make an application here that if you don't honor the women in your life that God has put in your life, and you don't treat them that as they're your equal, and just like Peter says that a man's supposed to treat his wife, if you don't treat them with honor and with equality, I say that God's sanction is going to be upon you as well. So all of us in this room, no matter how old you are, the way that you treat women in your life, but you men who are married, particularly the way that you treat your wives, if you don't do the things that Peter is saying here, then what is going to happen is God is not just not going to hear your prayer, but when God turns a deaf ear toward you, he is removing a level of his grace from your life. He is backing away. You're on your own. What you may experience as a disciplinary act, so I'm not suggesting God's removing himself and you're not a Christian anymore. If you're a Christian, you're a Christian. But if it's not that you're not a Christian anymore, but it's an act of discipline of God in your life, and he's removing a level of his presence from your life, a level of blessing from your life. He's saying, now you're on your own, and what you may experience as a result of this is what I would call the active opposition of God in your life, and who can stand? We're talking about God. Who can stand under the active opposition of God? Who can stand as God withdraws himself from any one of us and says, you're on your own. You don't know how to treat your wife. You're on your own. And so many men in our churches across America are, probably around the world, are experiencing frustration. And they think it's, I mean, the students on our campus, they think that it's the professor. They need a different professor, different assignments. They need a different seminary. They need a different job. Some of you may think, look, that it's your job, it's your boss, it's your... You just, if you could buy the thing that you really wanted, the new car, the new boat, whatever it is. When young men come to me on my campus, and they're frustrated, and they feel like they're life it together, and I'll start asking questions like, what's your wife's favorite color? I don't know. What does that have to do with anything? What's your wife's favorite restaurant? I don't know. Burger King. Oh, it's not Burger King. I can assure you it's not Burger King. Why are you asking me this? Why are you asking me this? You're asking me about my wife's favorite color and her favorite restaurant. I'm telling you, I need a different job. Maybe you do. What I'm trying to get at is, let's go first things first. What you think might be a problem with your boss might be a problem. It might be God disciplining you, and getting a new boss isn't going to change one thing in your life, because the real root of the problem may be you're not showing care for your wife. And you're under the discipline of God, and the frustration in your life is a result of the discipline of God in your life, not that you need a new boss or a new professor or a new teacher, or you need to be schooled somewhere else and not at home and all sorts of things. No, it's just that you might not be honoring the women in your life. Honor your mother and your father, young men. Your mother's a part of that. Honor your mother and your father. You might be experiencing the discipline of God in your life. Us men, grown men, might be experiencing the discipline of God in our lives. And so the care for our wives is directly connected to our walk with God and how God views us, and God's level of interaction with us. And it may be that he is withdrawn from us to such a degree that we're experiencing a deaf ear from him, which means a lessening of his grace in our life as a disciplinary act. You know, one of the things that I think keeps men from the challenge of the time needed to show attentive care to their wives and even their children and their families is what I would just call sheer busyness. Busyness. I don't know any details about any of your lives, but I'm telling you right now, we're too busy. Too busy. Now, I'm not talking about those of you that are working and trying to make ends meet and you had to pick up a part-time job because I'm not going to heap coals on somebody that's trying to provide for their family and trying to make ends meet. I don't mean you're too busy. It's possible some of us are too busy at work, but that's not what I'm getting at. I'm saying too busy doing a whole lot of other things that we think are good things but end up being not really the best things. We made a decision as a family last summer. Mentioned before how much we like baseball. My two oldest sons are really good baseball players. I know I'm their dad. I'm telling you, they're really good. And they're good. And we play baseball at a pretty high competitive level. It costs a lot of money. It costs a lot of time. My oldest son at 14 last summer, left-handed pitcher, can throw the ball, or was throwing the ball at 14, 77 miles an hour from 16 and a half feet. He's good. We were at a tournament last July, and I started adding up how much money we were spending, and I was in Knoxville, Tennessee with Gunner and two of the siblings, and Dana was in Cincinnati with Fisher playing in another tournament, and I was adding up hotel expenses and gas expenses and food expenses, and I called my wife and I said, did you realize how much money we spent in the last 11 days? And now how much money we spent since January? And how much time? And it was just all over me. So I came home and I got my oldest three children write down what they wanted to do with their life. Name 10 things you want to do in the next 5 years. A mission trip you want to go on, something you want to, an animal you want to kill. Just put it on there. I don't know what. Put it on there. I want to know what you want to do in the next 4 years. And it was great stuff. Great stuff. We want to go on some mission trips and places around the world, and Fisher put on there he wanted to kill a lion, which I respect. I don't know if we're going to be able to do it, but I respect that. So I pulled them all back together. Now, men, just hear me out on this, okay? I would suggest you do something like that. Hear me out on this, because we sat back down and I said, these are all good things. We're not going to be able to do any of them. We're not going to be able to do even one of these. Why not? Because we're spending all of our money and our time playing baseball, which was a good thing. We've learned a lot from baseball, character, hard work. When you make an error in baseball, it is there for everybody to see. It's a character builder. Football, you miss a block, nobody really knows it except when you watch the game film later on, the coach shows it, but the crowd doesn't know, and you miss a ground ball in right field, everybody knows it, and it's there. You can't hide it. We've learned a lot. So we had a dilemma. We made a decision as a family, and I got the boys together, and I said, look, here's the deal. I don't know if this is best for us. So we decided last August we were going to take a year and a half off of baseball. We've taken off from August. We normally would play fall baseball. By now we'd be in the throes of daily practices, workouts. Instead, I went to Africa for 10 days with Gunner. Next Friday, I'm taking Gunner, Georgia, and Fisher to Belize for 7 days to work in orphanages in Central America. This summer, my wife has taken my oldest daughter to Haiti for a week to work in orphanages in Haiti. In October, I'm taking Fisher, my 13-year-old, who will be 14 at the time, to Ukraine. Not only that, what I realized is that it created a lot of downtime in our home, opportunity for conversations that we hadn't had. And I asked my son, and I say that I'm a busy person. I like to be busy. I like to be doing stuff. And I asked Gunner the other day, I said, what? Does it feel like our home is more relaxed? He said, yeah. You know why? Because we're not going 100 miles an hour. I used to love to go 100 miles an hour. I like it, right? Busy people are important people. You're busy, you're important. You're busy, you're getting stuff done. Something's happening. What are we doing just sitting around? I'll tell you what we're doing just sitting around sometimes. It's giving opportunity for our kids to think about things, ask a question, talk about the question. Here's what I hated about it all. It was harder for me than anybody else to give it all up. Harder for me. I'm a 1 Corinthians 10 idolater. An idolater. So we say we're doing all sorts of things for our kids. You know what one of the one guy, several of the dads, even the coaches said, you know what, I think that's good. One dad said to me, he said, aren't you worried that you're going to deprive Gunner of an experience? I said, I'm petrified that I'm going to deprive Gunner of an experience, just not the ones you're thinking about. I'm petrified he's going to grow up and think, look, I love baseball. I'll always love the game, but that ain't all there is. I'm petrified he's going to grow up and not have a love for the nations. I'm petrified he's not going to grow up and have a vision for the world and for the gospel to reach the world. Not that he's going to have some 4-year experience somewhere at some college nobody knows about, just so he can play ball for 4 years. He may end up doing something like that, I don't know, but we're not living for that. And one of the books that a colleague and I are working on is called They're Not Going Pro. You know why we're writing that book? Because they're not going pro. Have you been watching the tournament? The NCAA commercial even says so. It's a commercial. You'll see it 1,000 times. It's a commercial showing the highlights of academic achievement of athletes. And it says there are over 400,000 NCAA athletes, and most of us are going pro in something else besides sports. It's their own commercial telling you and I they ain't going pro. I just got back from Africa. You know what all those kids are playing in the street? You know what they think they're gonna grow up and play for Manchester United, halfway across the world. You know what our kids think? They think they're gonna play for the Atlanta Braves, Cincinnati Reds, the Red Sox. There are 7 billion people in the world. 7 billion people. 750, give or take, professional Major League Baseball players. That's it. And that doesn't count the farm system, but you know the farm system is there only for a handful of others that are going to make it. The rest of those guys don't make it. They're playing in little parks all over the world, all over the United States, but they don't make it. They get paid a per diem rate, ride around on a bus and play, and they love the game. They're not going pro. There are approximately 7 billion people in the world, 70 NFL quarterbacks in the whole world. The whole entire world, there are 70, give or take, professional quarterbacks in the NFL. They're not going pro. Sports is a good thing. And we're not quitting. My son's playing Little League. My other little son, the boys, they're just at too advanced of a level. They just can't play right now. My little daughters play tennis and sport. We're not saying don't do sports. You don't have to do it at the level we were doing it. You don't have to do it because you think they're going pro and you're going to deprive them of some experience later on in their life. There are places in the world to see. There are people around here to help. There's time to be given to other things that have more eternal value. So I want to encourage you. Someone made me mad as fire about 3 years ago. And you know what he told me? I was so mad because I was busy. And he saw me running around like crazy. You know what he said? He said, "You're in charge of your own schedule." That made me so mad. Because I wanted to believe, no, I am not. I'm not the coach. I didn't decide when practice was. I am not in charge of my schedule. And boy, I looked myself in the mirror last July and I said, "Buddy, you are in charge of your schedules, my friend. You are in charge. You do not have to be running around like a crazy man. You do not have to be doing this." And there's been some good that's come out of it, and we're thankful for it, but you do not have to live like that. I think we're too busy. And I know that men have been being told, I heard James Dobson say this 20 years ago, right? "Man, you're too busy. People are too busy." I'm telling you, we think we're busy doing the right things because it's for the kids and we're dragging them here and there. I'm telling you, well, that may not be the right thing. And I don't know what's right for you. I don't know what's best for you, and I don't pretend to know. I'm just telling you, I just want to give a testimony of what God is doing in our family, in our home, in terms of discipling our children and raising our children to not just have character, but have a love for the nations, a love for the gospel. So that's where we are. So I wanted to encourage you in that and take a little Q&A. So if I don't know what we're doing with the cards. I see one here, but I think it's blank. So, and y'all know I'm not going to be able to answer all of them just because I'm not going to be able to answer all of them, but I'll sure give it a shot. Yep. Okay. Good. This one says, "As a father, what can I do, be doing in my boys' lives who are older?" So, you know, they're out of the home. They may be in their 20s. How can I help them? you know, it's possible. And so I don't know who wrote the question. I don't need to know. It's possible to reach back into the lives of your grown, we'll talk about boys in particular, your grown boys in their 20s, maybe even in their 30s. There may just be some repentance that needs to take place. And that's healthy. It's healthy. You might have to say, if you feel like you've made mistakes and you feel like that, you know, you just didn't know certain things you wish you knew then that you know now, but you didn't know them then, you might have to sit down and say, you know what, look, I owe you an apology. I repent of some of the things I did as a dad. I didn't know. I'm sorry. I think I probably was deficient in these areas, and I want you to forgive me. And it may be something like that if there's a strain in the relationship. An apology is almost never wrong. Repentance is never wrong. Repent for what you have, whatever you can repent of, and it's like an oil in the relational machinery that just softens the heart for reconciliation. Other ways, you know, parenting is different in the older years. My dad, what does he do? Same as you. He'll call me. He'll say, you know, did you go to the doctor? He's worried about this parasite, okay? He's worried about my parasite. And so, you know, he texts me, did you go to the doctor? I'm 44 years old. And trust me, I don't want this. I already told the doctor, one of us is going to die. This parent, me or this parent, one of us is going to die. And I'm going for the parasite. But I'm 40. He'll sometimes say, you need money? Well, I mean, that's nice, right? I mean, you know, I mean, no, but man, thanks, you know, but he's still, well, he's the dad, right? He's just, he never goes away, so it's different. It's different. And there's got to be a way to keep giving, to give your sons the space. They're grown men. They're out of the home. They're grown men. Give them space, but come along as a sage, kind of a wiser, older man. And pray for them. I know that I don't want that to sound bumper stickerish or trite, but honestly, God holds the heart of the king in his hand. God removes kings, establishes kings. He's the potter, we're the clay. I mean, look at all the number of passages that give clarity to the fact that we can pray, and God is sovereignly controlling this universe. And we can pray for God to reach into the heart of our sons who we may think be in the middle of a challenge, not listening to us, doing things that they weren't raised to do. Parenting can be gut-wrenchingly painful, and there's no guarantee. I have 7 kids. One of them is probably going to do something stupid, right? 2 of them might. I don't know. And so parenting can be painful. It's not for the faint-hearted. How does biblical manhood address emotions, vulnerability, compassion, grief? I didn't have a chance to deal with that, so whoever asked that, thanks for asking. We've been talking about some funny things that men do and don't do, but this isn't, you know, big boys don't cry, real men don't cry, real men don't have emotions. I don't think anybody should wear their emotions on their sleeve. Express yourself is not one of the 10 commandments. And so, you're the expression of every emotion is not necessary. And so, I've never taught my boys don't cry. They've seen me cry. I've cried at funerals. there are a couple of movies that just are gripping father-son movies that I tear up at the end of the movie every time. I cry at the Little League World Series, watching it on TV. It's inexplicable, I'm sorry, but watching those boys do something, I'll get teared up at a great play at shortstop, and my boys will look over and say, Dad, are you crying? Yeah, I'm crying. Big, you know, do something about it. I'm crying. it just chokes me up to watch those boys out there doing those plays. I just love the game, watching them do it. This isn't about the He-Man, beat your chest, kind of a deal. I think it's important for men to not bottle everything up. That's why I think accountability is important from man to man. As iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. And so men build relationships by collisions and there's sparks. When iron hits iron, there's sparks, and so stuff gets chipped away. That's why it's a great passage to realize that, yeah, there's some collisions, and a man needs to be able to share some things with another man and talk about what's going on. And so I think that God made us all with emotions, and those emotions are to be expressed in appropriate ways. And so, you know, with boys, and a lot of times it's always about crying, but when I drove up and saw Fisher with his skint knees that one time, we talked about it, and then I asked him this question, did you cry? No, sir. No, not because we're not allowed to cry, but because in our home, you get to a certain point, you don't cry over skint knee anymore. How many of you men still cry over skint knees? Don't answer that. unless it's you don't do. I mean, right? You don't. Why? Because there's a certain point that you don't cry over skint knee anymore. And but it's not that you never cry over anything. And so we cry. We get choked up. My boys have seen me get choked up saying nice things about my wife and gratitude in front of a whole group of people. So emotions are a part of this, and I appreciate the question just because I want to make sure that no one thinks that we're talking about something other than that. Do we have others? Is that what those are? Go ahead and bring those up. Let's see. Okay. Let's see here. All right. All right, that's a good, well, they're all good. Okay. Yeah, okay. Somebody's asked a question about daughters, and I did speak mostly about raising sons, but a father's role in raising a daughter is just as important as his role in raising a son, ironically enough. Now, that doesn't mean the mom doesn't have a place, but a girl's gender identity, sexual identity, is very tied into her relationship with her father and how he demonstrates appropriate affection to her, appropriate honor to her, especially when she gets a little older and hits puberty in the teenage years. A lot of times dads get a little freaked out about that, but that's really the time when a dad needs to be really showing unconditional love to his daughter to show her that there's a man in her life that cares about her, that loves her, who doesn't have to earn his love and earn his affections and earn his respect and care. I'll tell you this story just because most dads need to hear it. When my oldest daughter, she was about five, we went on just a little date. And I said, "What do you want to do?" She said, "I want to go to a restaurant, go out to eat, and then I want to go to the mall, I want to eat ice cream, and I want to hold hands walking around the mall." Okay, great. She knows that's what my wife and I do. I mean, what's a Christian couple supposed to do late at night? You know, karaoke? I'm fundamentally not coming home before the kids are in bed, so I'm trying to think of where do you walk around late? We end up at Home Depot, Walmart, 24-hour Walmart, holding hands. There's nowhere else to go. There's no good movie. And so she and I go on this date, and we're at the restaurant, and we're talking about candy and Barbie and dolls, and the conversation isn't quite as stimulating as I thought it would be. And so we get to the mall, and we're holding hands, eating ice cream, and we're talking about candy and Barbie and dolls. And in the middle of all of it, she said, "Hey, Dad, guess what?" Said, "What?" "Barbie turned 40. I don't know what. Barbie got a new camper. What?" And she said, "When I grow up, I'm going to have a husband, and I'm going to love him forever." Now, where did that come from? We were just talking about candy and Barbie and dolls. And I'll tell you where that came from. Because, man, if you have a daughter, you better know this. I didn't think about this, and I have no clue. She's holding the hand of her father at 5 years old. She's never been to a wedding. She doesn't know anything about event planning. She doesn't know anything about bridesmaids' dresses. She doesn't know one thing about anything about a wedding. She just has these warm feelings toward me, and she's assuming that one day she's going to grow up and have a husband and feel the same way about him that she feels about me. She is holding the hand of her father at 5 years old, fast-forwarding in her life, thinking about her husband. That's an amazing thing. And it's a gift that she gave me because, look, if I'm walking around holding my five-year-old son's hand, or five-year-old boys are not walking around in the mall holding their mother's hand thinking about getting married. I mean, if you raised them right, the only thing they're trying to think about is how to get out of the mall, right? If you did, have done anything right at all, they're trying to get out of the mall. She's never said that to me since. I mean, boy, the next time we went out, I said, "All right, we're going to that same restaurant. We're going to the mall, and you're going to say that same thing you said to me when..." You know, never said it since, but I'm just telling you right now. Those girls, when they see their dad, they're thinking husband. When they're holding the hand of their father, when they feel warm affectionate feelings toward their dads. They're thinking about their husband at ages you would never even dream. And so you've got to create these moments of one-on-one time with your daughters in a way. The boys and I can go outside and play catch and hardly talk at all, or shoot baskets and hardly talk at all. And we go in the home and we feel good about each other. We had a moment. And it felt good. We connected. And Dana would say, what'd y'all talk about? What'd we talk about? Well, we have to talk about anything for. We were shooting baskets. We had a moment out there. How can you have a moment without talking? Just trust me, we can have a moment, right? We had a moment. She can't fathom that there was any kind of connectivity at all because there wasn't a bunch of conversation going on. Now, I'm not saying our boys don't have conversation. I'm just saying we can connect. Daughters is different. It's just different. You've got to be a lot more intentional and create these moments of relationship building. Same thing, writing notes, connecting that way. When Georgia was little and the boys were, they'd go to this mother's morning out deal. I'd write notes on a little piece of paper and put it in there with their lunch. They couldn't read. They're not old enough to read, so their little teacher would read it, and he would just say, Dear Georgia, I love you. Dear Georgia, I'm proud of you. Dear Gunner, I'm proud of you. Nothing major. So one day, Georgia's walking around, and she's got her little patent leather purse, and it's stuffed to the gills with something. I said, Georgia, what's in there? And I open up, it's all those notes. She said, well, you know, it's all those notes you wrote me. Like, aren't the boys keeping theirs? Like, no, that's the spitballs in the ceiling of their room that they've been using that paper for. Now, think about this. She can't even read. So it's not that she's taking those pieces of paper and sitting in her room by herself reading the words on the paper. She doesn't know how to read at this point in her life. She just knows that all those pieces of paper have something nice that her father wrote about her on the piece of paper. And she saved them. And she, when she pulls them out, all she sees is a bunch of letters jumbled up. But she just knows those. That one might be the one that, where it said, Dad, I'm Georgia, I'm proud of you. That one might be the one that said, Georgia, I think you're a special girl. That one might be the one that said, Georgia, I'm so happy to be your dad. But she doesn't know. She just feels warm feelings when she pulls those papers out, knowing that I said nice things on those. So date your daughters. And don't underestimate this. Date your daughters. Take them somewhere. Take them out to eat. Do some nice things with them. Date them. The individual conversations that happen are irreplaceable. 2 years ago, I'm by myself with my 15-year-old daughter, and we're in the car. It's just the two of us. So 8 years after our first date, it's just two of us, and now she says, Daddy, is it okay if I like a boy? I mean, your first word is blank, no. I don't think so. But the answer is yeah. So she's sitting there. So we go fast forward all the way from 5 years old, holding my hand, and say, Dad, one day I'm going to have a husband. I'm 11 forever. Now she's 13. She's, Dad, is it okay if I like a boy? Yeah. That's why God wired it. You're old enough. You're going to notice boys in a way that you hadn't before. Let's talk about what we're going to do and how we're going to handle that and what this means and, you know, our philosophy of courtship and dating and where that fits. But you're going to notice boys. You know why we had that conversation? Because we've had hundreds prior to that. Hundreds. Intentional conversation, so that when she gets to that point, I mean, think about that. I don't know. My sister wouldn't, I don't think, would have asked my dad, hey, is it okay to like a boy? All right. let's see. Common problem. Let's see. Moms who overmother, but also moms who emasculate their husbands. Also, there's a particular question about homeschool and how sons can honor their mom while still pulling away. And the way that I'm going to deal with the homeschool thing, the way that a young man can honor his mother and still pull away is when the dad comes along and sits down with a mom and says, okay, he's going to start pulling away. He's going to start pulling away. It's time to keep it. Just know he's going to identify more with me and less with you. We're not going to tolerate disrespect, but don't latch on too hard. He's going to still honor you. He's still going to hug you goodnight. He's still going to tell you he loves you. But it's not going to be the exact same. And what you're going to have to do, so a dad and husband and father is going to have to come along and help the process. He's going to have to sit down with his son and say, here's the deal. I'm talking to you and I'm talking to your mother. I'm talking to you to tell you, nobody's disrespecting my wife. I'm not letting the guy across the street do it. I'm not letting the guy at the grocery store do it. And I'm not letting you do it. No man is going to disrespect my wife. That's my wife in there. That's the primary relationship in this home. You're not going to do it. Now, I am going to help you along. I know you're trying to be a man, and I know you're trying to express a little independence, and I know that the mothering part is, we're going to work on that. I'm going to sit down and talk to your mother, but you just know. You keep your mouth closed. You want to say something disrespectful, you don't say it. And you come to me. You tell me where things are the rub, and I'm going to help work it out. But this is where dad and husband come into play, and you're shepherding it along, and you're going to help people. Help everybody. In the situation where if a wife is emasculating her husband in front of the son, something's got to give. And, better to dwell in the corner of a rooftop, Proverbs says, than live with a nagging wife. And so it may be that you need to get somebody else involved. And I didn't say counseling, did I? You know that companies and men spend millions and millions of dollars across this country hiring consultants. So they're going, consultants. You know why we hire a consultant? Because we realize we have a deficiency, and we get a guy to come in and that's an expert in the area that we have a business deficiency, and nobody's ashamed of it. We're proud of it, right? We're proud of it. We say, oh, I hired a consultant. You're heroic because you hired the consultant. The consultant came in and said, oh, yeah, your whole accounting system is wrong. It's totally inefficient. Here's what you ought to do. It's going to save you millions of dollars. And then you do this, and you're heroic to the company. Men who will spend millions and millions of dollars on consultants will not even walk across the street to get consultation on his marriage. That he knows way less about, by the way. We know way less about that than we do our jobs and our vocation. We're reading book after book on leadership and maybe the industry that you're in, and maybe there's a periodical, a magazine for the industry you're in, and we're digging in. And when we realize, oh, I don't know anything about that, I'm hiring a guy, I'm going to call a guy, he's going to come and he's going to do a total workshop for us. We won't even make a phone call or walk across the street to tell somebody, listen, I got a challenge in my marriage. And I need a consultant. That's all. You need a consultant to come in, and you need a third set of eyes on this thing, a fourth set of eyes on this thing. So that's why I never say counseling. I say get somebody else involved. Just get somebody else involved. Come in, see what's going on, dig around a little bit, and find out what we need to do to fix this thing. It's a consultant, somebody to come in that knows a little bit more about it than you do, got a little bit of a different perspective than you do, that can see the trees instead of just the forest in a way that you are having a challenge to do. And so in the case of the emasculating wife or the nagging wife, it very rarely is solved by, you know, just one bigger, louder argument. Sometimes you got to get somebody else involved. And if it's to the point where this is kind of a regular thing going on, or you've noticed it in the lives of another man, come alongside. Hey, I'm noticing something here. Can I help you with it? Would you like some help? You want to pray about it? All right. Pastor, what? One more? Is that what you want to do? Okay. Let's see. All right. So this final question, I want to deal with the idea of divorce situation, because I know everybody's not in an ideal situation. It's possible, likely, in this room, but then even in our churches that are represented here, that men that didn't come, but man, obviously divorce is a big reality in our culture, and when custody is awarded to the mom, and it's boys in particular, custody is awarded to the mom, well, it puts dad in a challenging situation. So he may have limited time, weekends, whatever the arrangement is, and he's not in close proximity with his boys as much as he used to be. And so what I would say to that, part of this question talks about, you know, there might be things you can't do because you'll end up in court because of the custody battle, and maybe this person has in mind, you know, physical discipline, spanking or something other than that, or even other, you know, forms of discipline that the parent who does have custody doesn't agree with. So I know that these things can be knotty, complicated problems. I do believe that that's where the elders of the church can come in. I'll throw a few pieces of advice out, but long term, that's what the local church is about, for the elders and other men to come alongside you as a man who's in a challenging family situation and counsel with you, give you strategies based on what they know about you, based on what they know about the circumstances of the divorce, based on what they know about the legal circumstances, and can advise in some of these more detailed challenges that might be there. But having said that, aside from that, barring any other legal restraining orders and all sorts of things that I know can be involved, you just have to give as much time as you possibly can. And it may be making financial sacrifice. It might mean making a work sacrifice. It might mean traveling less. But you now have much more limited potential time with your sons and daughters in most cases. You have much less potential time. So now you have to maximize every minute that you're allowed to have and make sure that you don't diminish what has already been diminished, that you don't diminish it even further, and that you show every effort to be present in that child's life, everything from games to recitals to performances to rehearsals to whatever else it might be. And it might be you disagree with the busyness that the mom has put into place and the number of activities that the child is involved with, and she's not required to listen, she didn't have to. Well, then we're not going to be able to go back to Eden right now, right? I mean, we're going to, God is a redeeming God. Sometimes these situations get complicated enough that we don't see a viable path back to Eden. It will all get there. We have creation, fall, redemption, and then what is theologians call the consummation. Everything is made right, a new heavens, a new earth. We're going to get there. We might not be able to get there right now. And so what we're going to do is do the best we can, spend as much time as we can, give as much as we can, and demonstrate a level of godliness that may end up in reconciliation with the spouse, but if not, at least this conciliatory, unified relationship with the children that does not dishonor their mother. I know the temptation would be there in some cases. Don't say bad things about the mom. Don't say bad things about the in-laws. Just invest in those children the best that you can. I know that's not a silver bullet, but it means everybody's life is different now. And it's a challenge. Well, thank you for letting me be here. I've had a great, great time. And I'm going to turn it over to Pastor Chep. Thanks. Thank you.